Mark chapter 6. We're going to continue our study through Mark's gospel. If you're just joining with us, we are looking at the earliest account of Jesus' life. And what we are doing is we are trying to understand Jesus as he really is. That's Mark's purpose in writing. He's trying to tell us who Jesus really is. And that's a need, was a need back in that day, and it's a need today because people tend to take Jesus and make him into whatever version that they want. And, of course, if you invented Jesus, if Jesus of your own making really can be no Savior because he doesn't really exist. So we're going back, and we're trying to learn from Mark about who Jesus is and what he's come to do and make possible. Mark chapter 6, beginning in verse 45, immediately he made the disciples get into a boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the water. He meant to pass them by, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it's me. Don't be afraid." And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased, and they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. Have you ever thought that if God would just reveal himself to me, if God would just reveal himself to me in some kind of concrete, tangible way, if I could see a miracle, an unmistakable, indisputable, clearly identifiable miracle, then I would really believe. Then there would be no more questions, no more doubts, no more living for myself. Now, if I could see a miracle, then I'd really believe, I'd really live for God. I think at one time or other, we've all said something like that. I'm reading a book in the evening by a man named Frederick Buechner. I've read lots of his stuff through the years. And he's 80 years old, and they put together a book called Secrets in the Dark, A Life in Sermons. And he poses this question. I'm going to read the story from the book, and it is rather long, but I think it's worth our reflection. He says, if God really exists, why in heaven's name doesn't God do more to prove he exists instead of leaving us here in our terrible uncertainty? Why doesn't he show his face so that at last a despairing world can have hope? At one time or another, I think everyone asks such a question, believer, unbeliever alike. And we've all wondered sometimes, what would happen if God were to do just that? What would happen if God set about to demonstrate his existence in some dramatic, irrefutable way? Suppose, for instance, that God were to take the great dim river of the Milky Way as we see it from down here, flowing across the night sky, and God were to brighten it up a little bit and rearrange it so that all of a sudden, one night, the world would step outside and look up at the heavens and see not the usual haphazard scattering of stars, but written out in letters light years tall, the sentence, "I really exist. God is." He says, now, if I were going to try to write a story or a play about such an event, I would start, of course, with the first night that this great theological headline appeared there in the stars, with sun and moon to dot the I's and a tail of a comet to cross the T. And I would try to show some of the ways I can imagine people might respond. I would show some of them sinking to their knees, not because they're especially religious people, but just because it might seem somehow the only natural thing to do under the circumstances. Some of them I would show running back into their houses in terror, the guilty ones in terror of judgment, sophisticated ones in terror at the stark and terrible simplicity of it. God is written up there in the fire of the stars. And maybe everyone, to some degree, would feel some degree of terror. It's just the sheer and awesome vastness of the unknown suddenly making itself known. And there would be many tears of regret, I suspect, people thinking that if they had only known before, what different lives they might have had. And in many a person, there would be a sudden, wild upsurge of hope, like the sick old man lying in bed where he can't sleep, and he's looking out through his bedroom window. On the table, his clock tick-tocks his time away, but there in the sky, he sees proof, at last, of a reality beyond time. And I would want to touch at least on the peculiar astonishment of preachers and theologians. For them, too, there would be this great affirmation in the night, and that they would discover that, after all, they were more right than perhaps they had even been able to believe themselves, and they would marvel at the strangeness of it. What I would be trying to suggest in my story would be that the initial impact of God supplying the world with this kind of objective proof of His existence would be extraordinary. Churches would have overflowed into football stadiums and open fields. War would stop. Crime would stop. A kind of uncanny hush would fall all over the world. But as my story ended, I'm afraid in honesty I would have to suggest something else. Several years would go by, and God's proof of Himself would still be blazing away every night for all to read. And maybe in order to convince people the message was not just some million-to-one freak of nature, I would be tempted to have God keep on writing it in different languages, sometimes accompanying it with verse of pure color and music so celestial that at last the final skeptic would melt under the message of it all. Then the way I would have it end might be like this. I would have a child look up at the sky some night, just a plain garden variety child with perhaps a wad of bubble gum in his mouth. If this were a movie, I would have a close-up here of just the child's eyes with the stars reflected in them. And I would have him spell out the message syllable by syllable. Let's say that night in French. C'est moi le bon Dieu. And deep in the heavens there would be the usual strains of sublime music. And then I would have the child turn to his father, or maybe God himself. And the words that I would have him speak would be words to make angels gasp. So what if God exists? What difference does that make? And in the twinkling of an eye, the message would fade away for good, and the celestial music would be heard no more. Or maybe they would continue for centuries to come, but it would no longer make any difference. Would no longer make any difference. Is that possible? I mean, is it really possible that if a story like Buechner tells here actually happened, that after a while, it would not really make much difference? Well, interestingly enough, to me, Buechner's story may not be too far afoot from the story that Mark tells us right here, the one we just read. I mean, this is a strange story. It's hard to tell exactly what happened on that night. Mark's story is one of three slightly different versions. Luke leaves the story out altogether. John gives us a kind of a Reader's Digest version of it. The sea was rough. The disciples were scared. Jesus spoke and gets in the boat. And immediately they arrive at the other side. No ghosts, no amazement, no ceasing of the wind and waves. And Matthew's account is the account that most of us remember. It's the most familiar one because it's the one where Peter gets out of the boat and tries walking on water over to Jesus, and he gets partway out there and starts to sink. And Jesus walks over and helps him up and says, "Why did you doubt, oh, you of little faith?" And they all get in the boat, and I mean, the disciples are on their knees, and they're all worshiping, confessing, "You are the Son of God." Now, Mark's story, though, doesn't paint the disciples in such a good light. Mark tells us that Jesus' disciples were not so much in physical danger as they were in real spiritual danger. Look at that in verse 52. After Jesus comes out of them walking on the water, after they get over being scared stiff, thinking Jesus was a ghost, after he reassures them of his presence and climbs in the boat with them, Mark says they are utterly astounded, which Mark says is evidence that their hearts were hard. Now, what is that about? Isn't that strange? I mean, how could you have a hard heart after seeing an incredible miracle like Jesus walking on the water? But it's not just one miracle, it's two. Because they've just seen, within the last 12 hours, they've seen Jesus feed 5,000 men with five loaves of bread and two fishes. How could you possibly see two back-to-back, objectively verifiable miracles and it not make any difference? How could you end up with a hard heart after that? And as I think about that question, even more questions start flooding into my mind, like, what is it about the disciples' reaction here that causes Mark to say they have hard hearts? What's the lesson that the disciples missed when Jesus fed the 5,000? And what is that? What is the feeding of the 5,000? What's the connection between that and walking on the water? Lots of questions. We got our work cut out for us, so let's see if we can make sense out of what's going on here. Going back to the beginning, verse 45, after the miraculous feeding of the 5,000, Mark tells us that Jesus makes the disciples get into the boat. There's a little oomph in that word. There's urgency in that word. He hustles them into the boat. He hurries them into the boat. Question, why such hurry? Well, it's nighttime. Why do they have to cross the lake at night? Well, if you were here last week, you know that we talked about the fact that in this hill country region, that revolution was in the air. And which, by the way, I've mentioned this before. I study a lot in preparation for a message. I read the passage over and over and over. I look at the original languages. I read every commentary I can get my hand on. I scour the internet and I read people's sermons and I listen to other people's sermons and I take lots and lots and lots of notes. And sometimes I can be careless in my note-taking and then transferring from my notes to my message and not giving credit where credit is due. And last week I should have given Pastor Tim Keller, who I consider kind of a long-distance mentor of mine, I should have given him credit for these insights that I gained from this whole idea that the hill country was the hotbed for revolution, and also some of the background information on the redemptive purpose of miracles. I should have credited him. I was careless there from borrowing from him and not citing him, and I just wanted to correct that by giving him due credit. So Keller helped me see that they were in a hurry, primarily because, as John helps us see, they wanted to take Jesus and make him king by force. I mean, with a Jesus, with a Messiah like Jesus, who can feed people if Rome put up a siege or a blockade around Jerusalem? Well, they could live forever because Jesus just keep multiplying beds. I mean, if they went into battle with a Jesus who could heal like this, who would die? I mean, so here's a new Moses who could lead the people out of bondage and oppression. Here's a new Joshua who could lead them into a new day of promise and blessing. All Jesus needed to do was give the word, and 5,000 swords would rise in defiance against Rome. So there was this political, messianic uprising in the air, but Jesus would have none of it. And he didn't want his disciples to be contaminated by it, even though I think they got caught up in it, just as every other good Jew wanted a political, military Messiah to rescue them from Rome. But it's time to leave. They got to get out of there, verse 45. And Jesus rushes the disciples in the boat. He tells them he'll catch up with them in Bethsaida. He dismisses the crowd and heads up into the mountains to pray. Now, what you have to see here is that everything that happens next happens because Jesus is carefully orchestrating it all. Now, why do I say that? Because, first of all, we know from this section in Mark's Gospel, Jesus is intent on teaching and training these disciples what it looks like to be with him and do ministry like him. What it means to trust and follow him. We know that. That's what's going on in chapters 4 through 8. But we also know from this story, it tells us that they missed the lesson in the previous story. So Jesus is orchestrating events to teach them a lesson they missed, to help them see what they don't yet see. Verse 47, when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully. They were straining against the oars, for the wind was against them. Now here's the picture I want you to have in your mind. See, I want you to see Jesus sitting up on a mountain, out on a rocky ledge, his long hair and beard blowing in the wind, and he's looking down at the moonlit lake below. And what is he doing? Praying. Okay, yes, he's praying, but what else? He's watching his disciples straining at the oars, rowing against the strong wind, making no headway whatsoever. You got that picture in your mind? That's what's going on. You need to see this. Jesus sitting on a rock up on a mountain, looking down on his men in the middle of the lake, and they're rowing and they're rowing and they're rowing into the wind, against the wind, but they're pretty much dead in the water. And remember, this is so important because they're in this trouble because they had done what Jesus said. I mean, they were doing what he told them to do. They were heading for the place that he said to go. And to their thinking, they're thinking, we've done what Jesus told us to do. We're doing everything we know to do, but we're in trouble. You ever feel that way? Anybody know what I'm talking about? I mean, you raise your children to know God the best way you know how, and they rebel. Or you refuse to compromise your ethics at work, and you lose your job. Or you go to church, and you serve in the church, and you pray, and you read your Bible, and you give generously. But then the doctor says there's a suspicious spot on the x-ray. Or this loved one that you prayed, and you had everybody praying for that loved one. You're praying for healing, but they weren't healed. That person died, and you're like, what's going on? I mean, I've done everything God asked me to do, but my whole world is coming apart. What's going on? You feel that way sometimes. Those times, to me, feel like I'm rowing against the wind. I'm rowing, and I'm getting more and more frustrated because things keep getting harder and harder. And sometimes it's easy for me to become resentful, and I'm thinking, why do I have to go through this? Why is Jesus allowing things to be so hard? Or why is Jesus being so hard on me? You see the picture again. Jesus is up on the mountain, and the disciples are below on the stormy sea. And the disciples are externally battling the wind and the waves, but internally they're battling some confusion and frustration. They're not making any progress. They have no explanation of why Jesus is telling them to do the impossible, which is an echo from the story of the feeding of the 5,000. Maybe there is a connection. But they're alone in the storm, but they're not alone in the storm because Jesus is watching them. And that's what exactly, whatever's going on in your life right now, you might feel alone, but he's watching over you in his love. And by the way, he lets this go on a long time. I mean, because it was the end of the day when they said, it's late, let's dismiss all these people and send them away to their homes. And so by the time they fed all that many people, and it had to be early evening. It's nightfall. And it says that in verse 48, it was the fourth watch. It's about 3 to 6 in the morning. So they're rowing and they're rowing and they're rowing for hours out there in the middle of the lake. And he watched them struggle a long time. Why? Because he was teaching them a lesson they had missed. You see that? He's orchestrating everything that's happening to them to teach them a valuable lesson in what it means to trust and follow him. But it was a lesson they missed. He does the same thing with you. Same thing with me. So, verse 48, Jesus sees them rowing and rowing, not making any headway. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. He meant to pass them by. But when they saw him walking on the water, they thought he was a ghost and cried out. For they all saw him and they were all terrified. Now, this really is an incredible miracle. I mean, a living, breathing human man weighing, 160, 170 pounds, walking on top of the water. And for hundreds of years, people have tried to explain it away in all kinds of ways. I mean, some people say that Jesus was just walking along the shore in shallow water, and it just looked like it, kind of like this, or like this this next picture. Yeah, it looks like he's walking on water. He's just walking really in shallow water. Or maybe he walked on rocks that were just under the surface of the water, like this guy. You know, or maybe it was just some kind of Hollywood trick. One person even suggested somehow Jesus hypnotized the disciples into believing that he walked on water. Or, as I Googled possible explanations for Jesus walking on the water, I came up with this hit from the New York Times, April 4th, 2006. It says, Doran Knopf also wondered about this miracle in a measured scientific way. A professor of oceanography at Florida State University, he conducted an inquiry and found what might be a natural explanation. Ice. Writing in the Journal of Paleolimnology. Got it right beside my bed for nighttime reading. Dr. Knopf and his colleagues point out that unusual freezing processes probably occurred in that region in the last 12,000 years, icing over parts of freshwater Galilee. This has not happened in recent history, but there were much colder stretches 1,500 to 2,000 years ago. Al Gore would probably agree with that. If air temperatures dip below freezing, as sometimes happened then, surface ice would have formed thick enough to support human weight and inspire a biblical story. And from a distance, the scientists suggested, a person on the ice might appear to be walking on water, particularly if it had just rained and left a smoothed out, watery coating of ice. Well, there you have it. You don't have to wonder anymore. Problem is, none of these explanations do justice to what the text actually says. The Greek word for walking on is literally walking upon, on top of the sea. Verse 47 says they were out in the middle of the sea. So they can't be walking on shallow water, and how would they be in a boat on a lake that had iced over? So, I mean, now, we're definitely out of the realm of the ordinary here, but the question is, who better to believe, the actual eyewitnesses, Peter, James, John, Andrew, the guys in the boat, or some scientist that lives 2,000 years later? You say, well, haven't you ever been to college? I mean, don't you watch the Discovery Channel? I mean, everybody knows that the early church made up these miraculous stories to boost their ratings. Now, if that were true, I mean, wouldn't you want to end this miracle story on a high note? I mean, if you're making up stories to draw people to your movement, then why would you make up such an incredible, incredible story, miraculous story like this, and then end it by making your key leaders look like idiots? So, we accept that the miracle happened just like Mark said it did. Jesus comes to them walking on the water. Maybe he's skipping over the waves. I can't imagine that. Or maybe he's just really booking it over the waves. I don't know. For the disciples, the only possible rational explanation was he had to be a ghost. And they were scared to death. I understand that. I would be scared to death, too. But the thing I don't understand, or didn't understand, was this thing about how Jesus meant to pass them by. And it can't mean that he was just going to pass them by, because he said earlier that he saw them and he was coming to them. And there are as much debate about this part of the story as the miracle itself. Why was Jesus intending to pass them by? Just to cut to the chase, I think the best explanation would be that Jesus is continuing to reveal his true identity to these men. He's continuing to reveal who he really is to his disciples. That fits Mark's purpose in the book, to tell us who Jesus really is. The last time Jesus saved the disciples at sea, that story ended with the question, who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? That's the question everybody was wrestling with. Who is this Jesus? And the religious leaders can't deny that he works miracles and speaks with incredible insight and wisdom. But they see Jesus in league with Satan. Their hearts are hard. They've rejected what Jesus said and did by attributing his power to the devil. They saw, but they did not see. They heard, but they did not hear. The people in Jesus' hometown, they can't figure him out. Of course, they know who he is. He's Jesus the homeboy, Jesus the carpenter, Jesus whose brothers and sisters still live here, Jesus the illegitimate son of Mary. They know who he is. They can't account for where he got all this wisdom in his teaching or all this power in his working of wonders. They can't account for that, but they too have hard hearts because they, it says in chapter 6, verse 3, they took offense at him. They could not, they saw him, but they didn't see him. And so Jesus comes to the disciples out on the lake intending to pass them by. What does that mean? He's revealing who he is. What do you mean? Those of you who have been around a church for a while, is there something else in the Bible where God comes and passes by somebody? Yeah, Exodus 33. Moses says, I want to see you. I want to know you. And God sticks Moses in the cleft of a rock, and he passes by him and reveals to Moses his name, his true character. And that's exactly what Jesus is doing here. Verse 50, he comes to pass by them, and he says, courage, it is I. No fear. Actually, it could mean he's just saying, don't worry, it's me. But when you put passing by and this word in the Greek, it's ego me. It is the I am. Courage. I am. No fear. That's what he's saying. You put those two things together, and Jesus is revealing that he is the great I am. This is the name that God revealed himself to Moses at the burning bush. Jesus is revealing himself to these men like nothing else that he's done before. So what does that mean? It means that Jesus is not just a new Moses, not just a new Joshua. He's acting like God himself. He's acting like the God of Moses, the God of Joshua. He's God's Messiah, not just a new prophet that points people to God. No, he's anointed with the very power of God himself. N.T. Wright sums it up this way. Somehow the remarkable things Jesus is doing point in Mark's mind to the truth that Jesus is truly Israel's Lord, who is to be the world's Lord, anticipating his rule over wind and wave, over bread and fish. The sovereignty that Israel believed the Messiah would have over the whole world. Mark is offering Jesus to our startled imagination as the world's rightful king, the one who can and will put things right. That's the Jesus Mark is helping us see, but it's not the Jesus the disciples see. They miss that lesson, which is what Mark tells us next. In verse 51, he got in the boat, the wind ceased, they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves. Their hearts were hard. Now, what you've got to see is this. It's their astounded reaction that's not quite right. They were utterly astounded. Think, not he got in the boat and they were overcome with joy. Not he got in the boat and now, beyond all doubt, they trusted him. Not he got in the boat and they were so thankful that Jesus once again showed his great love for them by meeting their needs. No, it takes four Greek words to try to describe what's going on here. It's like they were out of their mind, beside themselves, not believing what they were seeing, totally, utterly astonished. Which, Mark says, was evidence that their hearts were hardened. Their inability to believe what they just saw, Mark calls a hard heart. So back to the question we began with. How can it be that men who see miracles like this end up with hard hearts? I mean, seeing a miracle like the feeding of the 5,000 and Jesus walking on the water, ought that not increase faith, bolster confidence in his power, flood your heart with thankfulness and love? But that's not their reaction. Why? Because they didn't understand the lesson of the loaves. Why? Because their heart is hardened. So what is a hard heart? What is a hard heart? Basically, a hard heart is seeing but not seeing. But the question is, why can't you see what's right in front of your eyes? You can't see because you want something more than you want God. You want him to be doing something in your life different than what he is doing. And you can't see. So what is it the disciples may have wanted Jesus to be doing that he wasn't doing? He wasn't playing by their rules. Okay, we got a fast rewind, and then we're going to just blitz right through this two stories again real fast. And I know we got people that are being translated. We translate into Spanish. And I know this is going to make it hard for the Spanish interpreter, but I don't have any way of not talking like that. See, I'm already caught up talking real fast. All right. It started back in chapter 6, verse 7, when Jesus sent these guys out with nothing on their first mission trip. They were to expect God to provide for them, which he evidently did. And then he sent them out also with the authority to do exactly what he was doing at the time, which was healing the sick and casting out demons. And they did exactly what Jesus empowered them to do. So they come back after a long time, maybe about 9 months, they come back and report, God in fact did provide for our needs. And God did in fact work miracles through us in your name. And Jesus says, great, let's go away to the mountain and let's get away by ourselves, get away from all these crowds, and let's rest. So they cross the lake and they get to the other side. And when they get to the other side, there's a whole crowd of people there. So they're not going to get any rest. And Jesus seems to have scrapped the plan, because Jesus spends all day teaching and preaching. So they get no rest, no special time alone with Jesus, and that had to be disappointing and frustrating. And these disciples, for whom God had provided all their needs, and who they themselves had met the needs of many people, when it gets late in the day, they come to Jesus and say, "Let's send the crowd away. Let them go find food in the surrounding villages and towns." But Jesus says something else. He says, "You give them something to eat." And this is where they blow it. What do they say? Verse 37, they sarcastically say, "Are you kidding? That is impossible. It would take 8 months of income to buy enough food to feed all these people." That is the first indication that something is wrong. Something is bad wrong. What should they have said? They say, "Let's send the people away so they can get something to eat." Jesus says, "You give them something to eat." And based on all they knew about Jesus and his heart to serve, and based on all they had done in Jesus' name in serving, the appropriate response would have been to, "You give them something to eat." The appropriate response would be, "How are we going to do that? Here we are. Tell us what to do. How are we going to do that?" You see, that's the right response when Jesus tells you to do the impossible. How are we going to do that? You see that? How are we going to do that? That's a faith response. It is a response that sees and understands and embraces that you can do all things through Christ that strengthens you. And he does it. He takes their inadequate resources and makes them more than adequate. Everybody's fed and 12 basketfuls of food are left over. But notice carefully, this is the second indication that something is wrong, bad wrong. There's no record at the end of this story that anybody was amazed. I mean, Mark's always saying, Jesus preached, people were amazed. Jesus worked miracles, they're amazed. There's no amazement. Now, I think that's very significant. Because the crowds, I can understand why they might be amazed, because Jesus is huddled up and he's got 12 guys around him, he's passing out bread, and they're going out and distributing the bread. The crowd may not have known what was going on. But the disciples, they watched Jesus taking that bread and breaking it, and breaking it, and breaking it. Every time they broke off, a piece grew back. They saw the miracle, but they weren't amazed. They weren't impressed. Why not? Because they wanted Jesus to be doing something different. What did they want? Rest? Revolution, all of the above. They want something. They're not getting it. The hearts are getting hard. And Jesus is going to show them that in this next thing. So he rushes them off. Why rush them off at night? We're tired. We were working all day. We came up here to rest, and now we're getting in a boat. We're going to row across the sea at night. What's going on with that? It doesn't make sense. And there's a storm brewing inside them that's going to be aggravated now by a Jesus-orchestrated storm on the outside that's going to aggravate the storm on the inside. It's not a life-threatening situation, but it's a heart-threatening situation. And to me, the picture of those men straining at the oars, rowing against the wind, and not getting anywhere, that's a picture of what a hard heart looks and feels like. You wouldn't think it would be true. But seeing miracles in the past, seeing God do great things in your life, things that can only be explained by His power, that those things are not enough to keep your heart soft and warm and faithful and true toward God in the present. Even seeing miracles won't make any difference in the long run if you miss the message of the miracles. And that happens when your heart grows hard. So what causes a hard heart? Let me give you three things. One, our hearts can grow hard when, for whatever reason, we resist seeing Jesus for who He really is. Our hearts can grow hard when we resist seeing Jesus for who He really is. That was exactly the problem with the Pharisees and religious leaders. They had preconceived ideas about what the Messiah should look like, and Jesus didn't fit the job description. He wasn't political enough. He wasn't religious enough. He wasn't holy enough, holy by their definition, because he hung out with all the wrong people. His miracles were impressive, but they just wrote those off to being the devil's work, not God's work. But what's more impressive here, interesting here, is the miracles didn't help the disciples see Jesus any better either. In fact, they are described here, their hard hearts. It's the same word used to describe the Pharisees and the religious leaders in chapter 3, verse 5. Because they too had a very narrow view of Jesus, which he's working to expand. He's showing them that he is God, the great I am, the world's true king, the one in whose story we live in, the one who has every right to call the shots in our life, to make the plan, to change the plan, to put the plan on hold, he as he sees fit. And that means, and this might sound heretical to you at first, but he is not your personal savior in the sense that he exists to save you from all the storms of life and make all your dreams come true. He's not that. He's bigger than that. He's the king, I tell you. When we don't see Jesus for who he really is, we try to make him into what we want to be. What we want him to be. Our hearts can grow hard. Second, our hearts can grow hard when we resent the things that he allows to come into our lives. Our hearts can grow hard when we resent the things that he allows to come into our lives. Like you wanted rest, but you didn't get it. Like you wanted a revolution. You wanted in the last election it to go a certain way. You want the economy to go a certain way. You want politics to go a certain way. Economics to go a certain way. It's not happening. Jesus isn't cooperating. And your heart can grow hard when you resent that God's not working in the way you want him to work. Maybe the miracle you wanted was healing for that loved one, but the healing they got was heaven. Maybe the miracle you want is for God to change your spouse, but the miracle you are getting is God working to change you. What about that? If you don't see that, let me tell you, it'll feel like you're rowing against the wind in your marriage. You won't be able to experience the miracle he's working to work in you. Maybe the miracle you want is for something new and different to happen in your life, in your job. Something new and exciting at school, in a relationship. But the miracle that God is orchestrating in you is to give you peace and calm and satisfaction and daily renewal in life as it is. And when you resent that, it's like rowing against the wind, straining at the oars. Finally, our hearts can grow hard when we refuse to really give ourselves to what God puts on our plate. When we refuse to really give ourselves to what God puts on our plate. If we don't give ourselves fully to the miracles that God brings into our life. And hear me now. I take it that anything that God invites us into or involves us in, if God is doing it, then there has to be some element of the miraculous attached to it. Why? Because God is in it. And he wants to do things that are beyond our ability to comprehend and our ability to pull off on our own. And if we don't give ourselves fully to it, even though it might be different than what we wanted to start with, if we don't give ourselves fully to it, we can grow hard and two things can result. One, we won't learn the lesson he wants for us to learn, and we got to go back through the lessons over and over and over again, which is what's going to happen in Mark's gospel. We're going to go back through. There's going to be another feeding to see if they get it next time. And second, if we don't give ourselves fully to what Jesus calls us to do, we'll be blind to who he really is and what he really wants to do in the present. You see, your heart can grow frustrated and resentful and hard when you see what God has done and what God is doing and you resist it, you resent it, you refuse to give yourself fully to it because you want something else more than him, because you want something different than what he's put on your plate. And that can blind you to the reality of who he really is. Now, thankfully, there is grace to learn and grace to move forward, because this story really doesn't end on a bad note. Look at verse 52. When they crossed over, they came to the land of Gennesaret. Interesting, they didn't make it to Bethsaida. We'll visit that later. They came to the place where Jesus had cast the thousands of demons out of the Gadarene demoniac. And when the thousands of demons came out, they went into the pigs. The pigs ran over the cliff, and their whole economy went into the tubes. And the people came and said, and begged Jesus to leave. Well, this guy must have been a good preacher, because as soon as they got out of the boat, in verse 54, the people immediately recognized Jesus, and they ran about the whole region and began to bring sick people to their beds, on their beds, and wherever they heard he was, and wherever he came, in villages and cities and countrysides. They laid the sick in the marketplaces and implored him that they might touch even the fringe of his garment, and as many as touched him were made well. Wow. The story doesn't end with the disciples being painted in a bad light. It ends with Jesus being painted in the most gracious, compassionate light. He doesn't write the disciples off because they didn't learn the lesson they should have learned. He doesn't give up on them and send them away. The fact is, they still haven't learned the lesson. Their hearts are hard. With Jesus in the boat, they're still, he just takes them to the next assignment. And they watch him working tirelessly, serving, continuing to heal the sick. And they get to be a part of all that. That is, what a powerful and loving and gracious Savior he is. Not the one that they necessarily wanted, which caused a lot of trouble, but the one they most definitely needed. Listen, you may be like me. I mean, sometimes I just don't get it. I am embarrassed to say how many lessons that God has tried to teach me, Him doing near miraculous things to show me Himself, or something that He wants for me, and I just don't get it. Maybe you can identify with that. But let me give you this note of encouragement. Don't beat yourself up about that. Just see Him for who He really is. Give yourself fully to what He's put on your plate, and move on with Him to what He has next. After all, it's His willingness to be with us, as broken as we are, as hard-hearted as we sometimes can be. That is the real miracle to me. It's not the outward stuff. It's not the external stuff that's miraculous. It's the fact that He continues to invite me to be a part of His story, to be with Him, to grow, to be like Him, to be sent by Him. That's the real miracle to me. I'll let Buechner close our time. He says, what we need to know is not just that God exists, that beyond the steely brightness of the stars, there's a cosmic intelligence of some kind that keeps the whole show going. But what we need to know is that there's a God right here in the thick of our day-by-day lives who may not be writing messages about Himself in the star, but who in one way or another is trying to get messages through our blindness as we move around down here knee-deep in the fragrant muck and misery and marble of this world. It's not objective, miraculous proof of God that we want, but the experience of God's presence. That's the miracle that we're really after. And He says, and that is the miracle that we really get. The words that Jesus spoke to us The words that Jesus spoke to us are the real miracles. They're not miracles that create faith like a message in the stars would create faith, but they are miracles that it takes faith to see. Faith in the sense of openness. Faith in the sense of willingness to wait and to watch and to learn and to listen for the incredible presence of God here in the world among us. Oh, our prayer must be, Holy Spirit, give us eyes to see this Jesus as He really is. And don't let our hearts grow cold and hard by trying to make Him into what we want Him to be. Would you bow with me?
God, we confess. We can come into a place like this and we can be hard. Our hearts can be hard because we won't let you be God. We resist you and resent the things you do in our lives, and we don't give ourselves fully because we're looking at somebody else's life, and we're looking for you to do something different. And we miss seeing you for who you are. Oh, God, be our vision. Be our focus. Let us lay aside and yield and surrender our preconceived ideas of what a personal Savior should be like. Let us yield those false, deceptive, right King, who's come to me.